Hello and welcome to another episode of the County Cricket Podcast in association with our friends at Better Cricket. I'm your host, Aaron, aka the Cricket Connoisseur, and on my left for today's very special episode of the County Cricket Podcast is none other than newly appointed Northamptonshire County Cricket Club head coach, John Sadler. So Sads, first things first, thank you very much for joining me here on the podcast today. It's an absolute pleasure to get you on for a chat. How's your day been so far, mate?
Aaron, how are you doing? Yeah, no, it's been all right so far. It's consisted of a school run, a school drop-off, making some sandwiches for lunches for my two daughters. And yeah, here we are. So it's been a pretty straightforward day so far.
Fair enough, Sads. Yeah, I mean, a well-deserved rest after what's been an incredibly long season. And I have to admit, obviously, you've been with the coaching staff at Northants. Have you enjoyed your time off after such a packed and busy season?
Yeah, it's been great. It has been a busy season. It's been a good one. I think I've enjoyed my time off. It's normally time off in October is actually time off where you switch off and you don't think about cricket. But in obviously these circumstances in the last couple of weeks and last month, how they've kind of evolved, it's certainly not been off. It's been consisting of phone calls and plannings and scribbling notes and brainstorming sessions and meeting a few people, chatting things through and planning for a winter programme and beyond, really. So it's not been off, but it's been nice to just kind of sit and reflect on the season and you know, get some things in place ready for when we report back.
Absolutely, Sads, absolutely. And of course, 2022 is a massive year for you personally, taking on the reins as the head coach of Northamptonshire County Cricket Club. First of all, congratulations on landing that role. That is an absolutely massive deal. It really is. And I have to ask, we'll get into the coaching aspects as the podcast progresses, but what was your immediate reaction to finding out that you'd landed that role?
Yeah, well, it was thanks for those kind words. It's an achievement I'm incredibly proud of so far to date in my playing and coaching career. I suppose it's probably the best achievement. But yeah, no delight. It was a nice phone call to receive. It was a nice offer to get from Northants. Reality kicks in. It suddenly becomes a bit daunting, but it's also very exciting at the same time. So it's one of those that I feel I'm ready for it as well, with my kind of 8 or 9 years experience at coaching at first class level now in different departments, a couple of different clubs, and it's one that I'm really ready to dive into and give it everything I've got. So it's an exciting time ahead. I know life's going to get a bit busier, but in a really good way. So yeah, happy days. Let's see how it unfolds.
Well, yeah, that's the attitude, Sads. It really is. And of course, we'll talk about that in a lot more detail as today's podcast progresses. But of course, before we get into all that good stuff, John, you know how we operate here at the County Cricket Podcast. We do, of course, take you all the way back to the origins of the John Sadler cricketing journey. So yeah. Sads, what were your first ever memories of cricket, either playing or watching the game? What do you first remember about the wonderful game of cricket?
Well, probably a similar story to many people, playing down my local club, Ossett Cricket Club, with my dad was playing in the second team, and my two brothers were playing at different levels, different age groups, and I was probably knocking about down the bottom somewhere in the nets and, just running around, running them up, playing, batting, not so much bowling, I don't think, but batting and fielding in nets or in different games. I played my first game as a seven-year-old for Ossett under-13s. Got three not out actually, so that was it. Little leg bounce off my legs, off and running, and that was it really. Off and running. My mum did teas at the local club, so it was very much a family commitment at the local club. That's going back. It's quite a while ago now, I suppose. But yeah, earliest cricket memory would be as a very very young lad at my local cricket club, watching my dad and my two brothers play.
Well, it's a lovely journey into cricket, I must admit, Sads, and I love the fact that you remember your score. I love that. Three not out and a little glance down. That is fantastic. And of course,
I think it was more of an inside edge actually down to final leg where I ran three, but in my head it's evolved into a nice little clip off my legs. But yeah, one of the two.
Sachin Tendulkar-esque. Perhaps. No, that is a fantastic story, John. It really is. And obviously very much family orientated in those formative years then. So in terms of your earliest cricketing memories and, of course, those earliest years, who do you say were your role models? Of course, family aside, who do you say in the world of professional cricket, maybe in the county arena or indeed the international stage beyond, who were your real role models and icons in those earliest years?
Well, obviously, you've said not family, but family, my dad and my two brothers and my mum have played a massive part. But I think, you know, I look back now and occasionally it comes up on social media about, you know, old footage of players. And the two that really strike me are whenever videos come up of Tendulkar and Brian Lara. As a young left-hander back in the early 90s, as a young teen, left-hander Lara was just... It was the dream. Whenever he was batting, I would sit and watch and make sure that we recorded it so I could rewind it and watch it again. He was great, wasn't he, to watch. And obviously Tendulkar, as I got a little bit older, he was, you know, just as exciting, and managed to meet Tendulkar once or twice, which was good. But just the whole kind of demeanour with Sachin, you know, his whole kind of how humble he was and how respectful he was to the game, you know, that brought another element. But I would say those two, certainly from my teens, probably slightly before that. My first person I remember watching was Robin Smith, you know, playing for England. Those square cuts and the way he used to chew his chewing gum with his helmet with no grill and little yellow earpieces and his yellow handles on his grey nickels bat. You know, even that kind of stuck with me throughout as well. I used to use grey nickels myself and like a yellow grip, and that stemmed from those Robin Smith days. So I think those two would be the... Sorry, those... Robin to start with, and then and as I got a little bit older and cricket became a little bit more kind of important to me, it was Lara and Tendulkar, which I suppose are not two of the worst role models to have.
No, they certainly aren't, John. To be honest, Sachin Tendulkar, of course, the leading test run scorer of all time, and Brian Charles Lara, an absolute magician with the bat in hand, seventh. The Trinidadian, of course, a legend here in my county of Warwickshire with that 501 against Durham in 1994. He scored 2,000 runs in that season with an average of 89. What a legend of the game, and the bat lift as well. Brian Lara made cricket look so appealing. I mean, what an incredible, incredibly gifted player, and someone, to be honest, John, I could watch all day. I really, really could. When I was first watching cricket, I'm going to be honest, I didn't really get to see Lara in his prime. But watching old archive footage, and in particular, one man I have to mention, Rob Alinder on Twitter. Absolutely fantastic for those, you know, VHS-style clips. He's really, really good if you want to watch the likes of Tendulkar, Lara, Steve Waugh, for example, in their prime. I mean, Brian Lara really could do it all. And sad to have to ask this because you mentioned those two. And of course, we can include Robin Smith in this. If you had to have a net session, a dream net session, with one of those three players, who would you choose and why? It's a tough question.
I don't know if I can answer that question, Aaron, to be honest. Well, I'd have to narrow it down to Lara or Tendulkar. I think Robin was a bit. I was younger, and I still get goose pimples when I watch him now. But Lara and Tendulkar, I mean, they were the kings, weren't they? So if I had someone to bat for my life, it would be Tendulkar. If I had to pay to go and watch someone, it would be Lara. So I don't know if I can answer that question. What I would probably try and compromise is that... Tendulkar, if I was having a coaching session with him, then, you know, Tendulkar might be feeding and Lara might be doing the demos or vice versa. I'd try and get them both in there, to be honest, but I don't think I can answer that question. When I get asked who's best, what I always, my go-to line is my understanding that Lara used to ring Tendulkar when he had a bit of a problem. So in that regard, it probably just puts Tendulkar slightly in front of Lara, but, you know, it's an ongoing debate that one will probably never get answered. But I don't know if I answered your question there, Aaron, but they were certainly two good ones to watch.
To be honest, John, I don't think I could answer my own question there anyway. I'm going to be completely honest. I mean, with both of them, there's so many different reasons why you would select either, and two true bona fide legends of the wonderful game of cricket. I mean... could watch those two bat for absolute days. It was a real honour and privilege to watch either of those two at the crease, to say the least. And of course, both of them, I alluded to Lara earlier, and of course, in his early days, the great Sachin Tendulkar played for Yorkshire County Cricket Club, which takes me nicely onto, of course, the title of our podcast, the County Cricket Podcast, and the county circuit. So, John, what were your first ever memories of cricket, in particular in county cricket, in the county cricket arena? What were your first ever memories of county cricket?
Probably one day cricket that was on television when Yorkshire should get through to a semi or a quarter final or a semi of the knockout cup. Was it the I can't remember what it was in those days. It was the, you know, Benson Edges, was it, or something like that? And it used to be 60 overs. It used to be a red ball. You know how the game's evolved, but it'd be those kind of old school Yorkshire players. Martin Moxon would be playing, David Byas would be playing, those kind of guys, that kind of era. And I remember my dad taking me, I remember going on a Yorkshire under 14s cricket tour actually, and we had to travel down south somewhere. On the way, we went past Worcester, and I think Yorkshire were playing against Worcester. So I remember going to watch there for a day on the way down south, and just kind of being enthralled by the buzz and seeing some of these guys that I'd seen on TV. All of a sudden, I could see them live and in the flesh. I managed to get a couple of signatures that day. And then being up at Headingley as a young man, kind of going through that pathway journey as well. So it's all a bit of a blur, but I would say those kind of early days where they're wearing the old jumpers and they were playing one day cricket with a red ball, which seems a long time ago now.
Well, yeah, the game has evolved tremendously since then, hasn't it? Of course, with coloured clothing as a result of Kerry Packer's World Series. Then we've got the white ball. And of course, now it's 50 overs as well. And we've got the Royal London One Day Cup after having the 40 over competition for years, with like the Pro 40, the YB 40, the Clydesdale Bank 40 as well, which Warwickshire won in 2010. I mean, yeah, it's crazy how the game has actually adapted over the years. It really is staggering when you think that, for example, county cricket has existed for, what, 180 years? Yeah. And then we've had all of these different competitions. We've got the T20 as well. It is staggering how much cricket does evolve in such a short space of time. And Stan, you mentioned there about Yorkshire. What do you remember from your days with the White Rose? And in particular, from your debut for Yorkshire? Because as a Yorkshireman, of course, you mentioned there about age cricket, academy cricket, playing a bit for the second 11 as well. What do you remember from your debut for the White Rose?
Well, my debut, I think, it was a tour match against the West Indies, I think, a one-day match. And I think Chris Gayle got me out. I remember kind of getting I think it was on an early teens or late teens. I don't think we got many that day. It was cold and it was a bit grey at Headingley, but obviously it was a big occasion. And I think I played a couple of nice shots. We were a bit of a hole, and I tried to hit the off spinner over the head, and it was Chris Gayle. And as I'd hit it, I think I'd connected with it really well. And I thought, oh, it's four, one bounce, four, beautiful. And all of a sudden, from nowhere, Chris Gayle kind of plucked his hand up, obviously being taller than most people, and caught it one-handed and kind of threw it off very nonchalantly. And I had to toddle off and, you know, feel sorry for myself getting out. And then I remember getting a telling off from Arnie Sidebottom, who was coach, because I should have been selfish and got a big score. But so yeah, that was it really. And then I think they came out and smacked it. So it was quite a short-lived affair, but it was, you know, it's in the memory bank. And yeah, I didn't really play much for Yorkshire, but that was it. That was the debut.
Well, yeah, John, I mean, either way, I know you said there you didn't really get to play a lot for Yorkshire, but you made your debut for them. I mean, to play for your home county, I always say this on the podcast, that can never, ever be taken away from you. That moment where you receive that cap, you play for your home county, it's always tremendously special. And in terms of your playing days, John, in hindsight and retrospect, what do you say was the highlight of your county cricket career from a player's perspective? Because you not only play for Yorkshire, you, of course, went on to play for Leicestershire and Derbyshire as well. Yeah. What do you say was the highlight from those years in the county circuit?
The highlight would definitely be winning the T20 twice in 2004, 2006. I think whenever you play, whenever you look back and you look back on memories of winning competitions with, you know, with people around you, they're obviously the highlight. There's some individual highlights in there as well, hundreds and certain innings that you play on certain days, and, you know, they stick in the memory. But, you know, any time you win a competition, it's a special occasion. You know, you see your teammates 20 years down the line, and conversation quickly goes back to, I remember that day we played such and such, I remember that final this day. I mean, we got to when the T20 started, it was a bit of a novelty actually. Nobody knew how it was going to go, but at Leicester we were very led by Nico and Jeremy Snape, actually, two of our leaders, and Daffy's captain. They kind of led it and said, look, some teams are we're not sure how to play this T20 lark. We don't know what it's all about. Some teams are going to play the young ones, some teams are going to have a bit of a knockabout and what have you. But we said, well, let's go and try and win it. So we planned and we spoke and we gave people roles. We won a few games, got a bit of momentum, and ended up we're having some success. And I think we caught a lot of teams off guard in those early years in 3, 4, 5, 6. And we got to four finals days. I only played in three of them because I missed the finals day in 2005 because I had a broken collarbone, which I thank Brett Lee for. So thanks for that, Brett, if you're listening. But, you know, for us as a club to get to four finals days and win two of them very much as underdogs was a special occasion. I remember the first one won at 2004 at Edgbaston. We beat Surrey in the final, and, of course, everybody wanted Leicester to win. wanted the underdog to win. So we felt that we had kind of 90% of the crowd there on that day, and it was a brilliant occasion. So definitely those two trophy wins would be right up there. They'd be the highlight of a playing career that I had. Yeah, definitely.
Well, there's no surprises there at all, Sads. I mean, Leicestershire, of course, as a county, the most successful ever in the T20 Cup / T20 Blast, of course, as it's now been known since 2014. Yeah, three times winners. If I had to ask, between 2004 and 2006, I know this is a ridiculously tough question again, Sads. I think you know exactly what's coming. If you could relive one of those days, which one would you choose and why?
Well, in 2004, I had a smashed nose because in 10 minutes before the final, I was doing some throwdowns and Darren Robinson was throwing a few balls. And there was a bit of dew on the outfield and I was kind of doing a few pull shots just into the net. We'd won the toss and we were batting. I was batting at four or five, whatever it was. And I went to pull the ball. It was literally my last shot and I missed it. I played it too soon. It got plugged in the ground and I played the shot too soon and it smashed my nose. And I spent the first 10 minutes, sorry, spent the first 10 overs of our batting display with my head kind of raised up. So to be honest, I didn't even see the first 10 overs when Darren Maddy was smashing it to all parts. So I think to answer your question, I'd probably go for that first one again so that I could watch it a little bit closer because it was a bit of a blur with a smashed nose. Mm. But there you go. So it's a story to tell the grandkids. It's still on the photographs, actually. When you go to Leicester and you see some of the photographs of us when we're celebrating, there's me with kind of blood all over my face and tampons stuck up my nose. So it's quite an interesting story to tell.
Yeah, it is. It's a very, very interesting one, that, Sads. Yeah, I mean, probably an interesting choice, or in fact, no, the correct choice. I'd say that is the correct choice, actually, with regards to that, in order to relive it, of course, without all of that happening, though. You'd rather not have that experience again, of course, all the blood. But yeah, I mean, two incredibly special days for Leicestershire. And they have been a really, really good county, in particular, punching above their weight in T20 cricket. But I suppose on the flip side of that, we mentioned there about proudest moments. Of course, cricket, as much as we'd all love it to be just like that, all proud moments, everything going correct, centuries every games, fives every games. Unfortunately, the game doesn't play out like that, as we all know. And you do have heartbreak, you have despair, you have, you know, you have moments of disappointment in the game of cricket. So what do you say was your toughest moment from a player's perspective in the county circuit, John?
Toughest moment would be getting released at the end of 2010 for Derby and sitting in the car park and, you know, having a bit of a cry, to be honest, thinking that, you know, the dream is over. Everything I've lived and breathed for the last 15 years since being that schoolboy watching the greats, you know, all of a sudden it's come to an end and the prospect of getting another contract somewhere was done. So that would have to be a low point. There's various low points and, you know, you need those low points to come back from. But that would be probably the toughest moment to get over where I finished and I was officially out of the game with very little prospect of getting back in. So that was a tough time.
I can imagine. It is. It's always incredibly tough, isn't it? The moment where, I mean, you have to exit the game. And Sads, if you're comfortable talking about it, of course, yeah. What do you remember from your final professional game in the circuit? What do you remember about that day for Derbyshire? Is there anything in particular you can remember and glean upon from that day per se?
I actually can't remember which game it was. I remember my last first class game because it was at Lords and Gareth Berg actually got me out. He was one of our players now at North Ants. So Berg, you know, I will listen to this at some point, but it's a conversation we have had, so it's fine. But he got me out and I remember just walking off at Lords, got me off, nicked off down the slope. I remember walking off thinking, well, that could be it here because I've struggled for form. I've not got many runs. But look, it is what it is, isn't it? You know, I can look back and think that if I had my time again, there'd be things I'd probably do differently, as we all would say that. But what I would say is that the good memories and you know, the match-winning performances and the winning trophies, alongside the disappointments and the, you know, the tough times that you have to go through, that shapes you, doesn't it? It shapes you as a person, it shapes you as a character. And I think anybody who has any kind of longevity in the game as a player or as a coach or in anything that they do, I think that they have to go through those good times and the bad times because then you get a bit more of a balance of what's real. You know, and if you can try and stay consistent throughout the good times and the bad time, not get too up when you do well and not get too low when you're struggling, then I think that helps you kind of you know, stay a bit more level. So, but look, you have to go through those good times as well as the tough times, as you've said.
100%, John, you do. And we always mention it here on the podcast, in particular about the mindset and the psychological aspect of the game. It's about maintaining that even keel. It's when you have a bad day. I mean, I actually spoke about this the other day with Craig Miles on the podcast, of course. You can go and listen to that on the website in due course. But he mentioned about having a chat with Mark Robinson and saying turning a bad day into an okay day into a good day, and a good day into an excellent day. And I do think that's quite a positive way of looking about it, because in cricket, it is a sad reality, but you are going to fail more times than you succeed, in particular as a batsman. That is a truth that you just have to come to terms with very, very early on in your career. And if you can do that, if you have that ability, that resilience, that mental fortitude to overcome those hurdles and, you know, really just maintain that even keel, as I was mentioning, you'll go far in the game. And it's one thing that does link every single one of these legends of the game, of course. Every single one of them's had adversity. Every single one of them's had times when they would have felt down, they would have been heartbroken. Look at Tendulkar. Tendulkar is arguably the greatest batsman of all time, isn't he, John? And yet he got ducks. He had disappointments. He didn't win every single World Cup. He never scored a century every single game, did he? But he had the ability and the resilience, the fortitude to bounce back from those. And of course, put in performances when his team needed him the most.
He did. And again, you know, you have to accept that those days will be, you know, there'll be those tough days where you don't get any runs, or you do drop a catch, or you don't quite do what you're there to do. But it's how you bounce back from those. And it just makes it even more special when you do have your good days, I suppose, isn't it? So again, experience tells us, and it's easier sat here kind of with a bit more experience behind us to say that, you know, don't dwell too much on the bad days, take what you can, learn from them, and then, you know, enjoy the good days when they're coming as well. But it's judge it more over a period of time. You have to go through those bits of adversity to be able to appreciate the good times as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely, you do. And so any budding cricketers out there listening to the podcast, do take this on board. I'm going to be honest. I mean, we're over 100 episodes in. Before the podcast began, I was a little bit wet behind the ears. I'm going to be honest. I was a bit naive when it came to the game of cricket. But when you actually listen to this, take it on board, the same things pop up again and again and again. And it's through experience, of course. You only get that through playing matches, overcoming those adversities per se. But do listen to it. Take it on board. Get prepared now. Okay? That's what I'd say to any budding cricketers out there. And of course, Sads, talking of your playing days, I just wanted to touch a little bit upon retirement, if I could. Because that, again, is a topic which has popped up quite a few times here on the pod. How did you find retirement? Because, of course, you went into coaching, and we'll get into that in due course. But that initial stage where you're no longer playing in professional cricket, was that a bit of a shock to the system for you personally?
Absolutely, yeah, it was. It was what I'd known for 15 years or so since finishing school. So it was a real shock, I think. I think initially it didn't quite hit home. It, you kind of finish the season and you go into a winter where you break up anyway and everything's normal. I think the time that it really kind of kicked in with me was the following March, where all of a sudden the grass has been cut and the leaves are starting to show on the trees again. People are getting outside and you kind of get a feel that this is now normally this time of year I'm supposed to be outside and pre-season nets and training, and there's a pre-season tour looming, and all of a sudden that had gone. And the players that I'd got very close to in those last 15 years, all of a sudden that was gone. So my cricket fix was gone. I still played some league cricket, which was good, and I enjoyed it. I got my cricket fix, still enjoyed trying to do my best at that level. But the camaraderie of being and the recognition of being a professional sportsman was suddenly taken away from you. So I'll be honest, it was tough. It was really tough. It was. It took me a couple of years to stick my chest out and, you know, and be proud of what I'd done on the cricket field. I think I played 220 odd first 11 professional games. So if somebody had offered me that as a 16-year-old, I'd have snapped their hand off. But it took me a couple of years to kind of acknowledge that and be proud of what I'd done on the cricket field, because it didn't end on my terms. It ended because somebody else ended it for me. It dented my confidence quite a lot, and it took me, like I say, it took me a couple of years to stick my chest out and be proud of what I've done. But again, you have to go through these times. You have to go through the tough times and the down times to appreciate the good ones.
Indeed you do. You do, John. That is very, very true indeed. And having had that disappointment, and as you alluded to there, talking about league cricket, playing in grassroots cricket, How did you go from all of that disappointment, the shock to the system, you know, going all the way back to, I suppose, the roots with you know, village cricket? How did you go from that into the world of coaching? What do you say was the spark that took you on the first steps to the world of coaching in cricket?
It's a really interesting question. I mean, firstly, the biggest thing I had in my favour was I had a good support network around me. PCA were brilliant, but more important than that, my wife and my family were brilliant around me. So they, you know, they obviously took the brunt of it when I was probably a bit down. But I got into coaching through necessity, really. I didn't really have much work. I didn't have a job to suddenly walk into, those, you know, the days where jobs for the boys a bit harder to come by than they were maybe years ago. But I got into coaching through necessity. I started doing a little bit of local coaching, a bit of private coaching, and I got a real buzz for helping somebody, whether it was a, you know, a young boy or girl, teaching them how to catch, or whether it was somebody a bit more advanced and helping them technically a little bit. I got the same kind of intrinsic buzz, that same kind of, you know, inner reward for making a difference. And it kind of spiraled from there. It snowballed from there, should I say. I got a call from, I did my level three in my last playing days at Derby, and I really enjoyed that. And then I got invited by Gordon Lord onto the level four. He said, look, we know you a little bit and we see something in you. We want to develop your journey a bit further. No need to interview, just come and get going. And I really enjoyed that level four process. So I had 3 years out of the game from finishing playing to when I actually started coaching with Derbyshire second team. And I must say, in that 3 years, I learned more about myself through the level four process, you know, all the different kind of ways that they do that. They've got a lot of experts who come in, and I'm a big advocate of the level four and the coach education system. So, but I also did a lot of kind of batting coaching, and I learned more about the mechanics of batting and the art of batting in that 3 year period, throwing balls and throwing tennis balls to people of all different ages and abilities. I learned more in that 3 years about batting than I did in a 12-year playing career or 15-year, whatever it was, playing career, because as a player, you sometimes turn up and you do it and it's natural and you crack on, whereas had to really understand any advice I was giving to somebody else to improve their game. I had to really make sure that it was, you know, it was backed up with some evidence, or there was logic in it. So, yeah, that 3 year period, finishing playing to then kind of getting going with Derbyshire in the second team and the batting coach role, was crucial for me. It was nice to be out of the game for 3 years, because it allowed me to move on from being a professional player, so that when I came back into the professional circuit again with Derby, I came in a completely different capacity. I was in as a coach as well, and I had to kind of make my name as a coach. So that 3 year period from player to coach was a really, really interesting journey of self-discovery and awareness, but you know, it's one that really helped.
Well, sad that it's wonderful to hear. It really, really is. I mean, that's put a nice smile on my face. And if you don't mind, I would like to ask a couple of follow-up questions, because I am interested with regards to coaching, you know, the mechanics behind this game that we all love so passionately. So the first one I had with regards to that is the level four process. Because, of course, for aspiring coaches out there, they might not know the ins and outs of it. I mean, would you just be able to give, you know, a brief outline as to what that process entails, what you actually have to do, and I suppose the biggest lessons that you learnt from that level four process with the ECB?
Yeah, well, again, I thought it was a fantastic course and a fantastic journey. It came at the right time for me. It has changed slightly now, I think, in the way that they do it. I'm not 100% sure how it's done nowadays, but when I did mine back in 2011 and 12, there was an academic side to it as well. So it very much kind of challenged you, got you out of your comfort zone. There were, you know, dozens and dozens of different experts in their chosen field, whether it's kind of management skills or biomechanics or batting or bowling or physiology, whatever it is, all these different ways we had experts coming in. I think anybody with an open mind who wanted to be there and wanted to learn had no choice but to learn, because there were so many good people talking about what they did and what worked for them, that there was so much information being thrown at you. But it was also a journey of self-discovery as well, where, you know, you learn about yourself, different learning styles, different kind of character types, and there's different ways that was done. And you also get to the camaraderie that you build up with fellow coaches or fellow aspiring coaches as well. You build up that network where you can bounce ideas off each other. So a lot of that level four for me was a real good learning curve. You know, still some of the stuff there that I use now and what have you, particularly from a management perspective and understanding people. But it's very much there to kind of assist you with your own beliefs. But I was a big advocate of the level four. I thought it was fantastic. The academia side of it as well, having been a young lad fresh out of school who ran around a cricket field every day for 15 years, all of a sudden he has to write assignments and, as a postgraduate diploma and all that. It was a challenge. So again, getting you out of your comfort zone. They did some really good stuff, actually. They did role play. They put you under pressure. I had to do an interview. At the end of the process, I had to do a 45-minute interview about the level four, what I'd learned. And then they put you through a two-hour kind of Viva or Viva, chatting, asking you different aspects of different areas. And it was quite, it puts you under pressure, it makes you, and it's almost getting you ready for the real world as well in a job interview perspective. So I just thought the level four process from start to finish was excellent. It was really good, and I'd be a big advocate of it.
Well, there you go, folks. Any budding aspiring coaches out there, take it on. That's what I say. Take on the challenge if you're able to, of course. I mean, there are different levels. You've got level one, two, three, and of course, four being the top one, I suppose. But from the sound of that, sounds very, very interesting indeed. So yeah, any aspiring coaches, definitely do check it out. You can find that on the ECB's website. And the other follow-up question I had was with regards to the batting coaching in particular. You mentioned about lessons learned, but what particular lessons did you learn? Because when you're in your playing days, you were living that, weren't you? You were the batsman. How does it differ in terms of from the coach's perspectives? Do you pick up on different things with regards to batting techniques, the biomechanics, for example, of batting? What kind of things did you learn from taking that new role on?
Well, I learned that there's no one size fits all. There's no kind of one little golden nugget that unlocks everybody's batting. Everybody does things differently. Everybody moves in a certain way. Everybody bats in a different style. Whether it's trigger movements or back lifts or head position or whatever it is, or pre-match routines, what works for one doesn't necessarily work for another. So that was a big thing, is that anybody who kind of thinks that there's a couple of golden nuggets out there that means that everybody's going to be able to have success, unfortunately, it doesn't quite work like that. I think you've got to understand how your own body works and kind of work with what you've got and try and encourage what you've got and make the best of it. So that was a big thing. I mean, you learn along the way. There's certain points in my coaching career that suddenly spark a memory back to when I played. And there were times where I was in good form, times where I really struggled. And I think having a blend of those experience from your playing days also helps you empathize with the players when you know what they're going through. In some regards, you don't have to have the feeling of getting out and walking off for no runs and having that disappointment, so you don't miss that. But in other regards, you get a small piece of that with every single batter who walks off for no runs, because you're trying to support them and you just want the best for them as well. So it is very different coaching to playing. But I think the biggest learning from a coaching perspective with the batting is that no one size fits all. And I think if you can coach the player and work with the player and their character as well as what they do, technically, then you're somewhere near. A word I try and use a little bit is the method. A lot of people get a bit embroiled technically. But for me, it's more about the method that you've got. So by method, I mean, what game plans have you got and how are they aligned to kind of your technique and how your body works? I think if you've got a method and a clear method and a well thought out, planned and practiced method, I think that's a better place, a better focus point than looking simply at a technique or anything like that. So, but again, it's ever evolving. It's different. My philosophy now, I suppose, is slightly different to what it was when I started my coaching journey. But again, you've got to be open-minded to new ideas and new things. So, but not one size fits all, and what works for one doesn't necessarily work for another.
Very true. That is extremely sated advice, to be honest, Sads, because we see this all the time, in particular on social media. And of course, people want to improve their game, whether that's batting, bowling, fielding. But the problem is, some people try and look for shortcuts, and unfortunately, they simply don't exist. Not at least in the professional game. Okay, you have to work individually. It's individually tailored things. It's not one or two, as you said, golden nuggets of information or shortcuts which take you to the top. You have to find that out for yourself. And I've noticed that from so many coaches. That's something that Stephen Jones told us. to be honest, when it comes to fast bowling, there's no one-size-fits-all method to bowling like Sherbaktar or Brett Lee. But the fact is, there are things that you can put in place, of course, which will help you get there, but it's about the individual. And that is something that is really, really important to note for any aspiring cricketers out there. And in terms of your coaching journey, I suppose, Sads, okay, having coached at Derbyshire, Leicestershire, and of course, have now been assistant coach to David Ripley, an absolute legend on the county circuit, and of course, will be taking over his role come 2022. What do you say have you learned from working alongside guys like David Ripley, for example, and of course, Graham Welch, Pop, as we know him here in the Midlands? What do you say have been the biggest things you've learned in terms of man management, in terms of coaching style? What things have you picked up over the years from working alongside those people?
Well, there's loads of things that you pick up. I don't know if I can kind of name them all now, but I think the biggest thing is that the lads buy into the lads at North Ants and at Derby under Pop in those days. The lads buy into the coach that is believable. And I think if the coach is genuine, and I think if the lads realise that, you know, the agenda is purely for them to get better as people and as players, then I think the lads will pretty much kind of go with you. I think that's not necessarily from in any specific job title, but I think in life, I think if people are genuine and there's no hidden agenda and that you care for people, I think that's a good starting point. And they're certainly qualities that the guys that you mentioned there, Pop and Rips, had in abundance. You know, they cared for the players, they cared for them as people, they tried to offer support. And I think if you can try and offer that support and be consistent over a period of time, then I think the players tend to buy into that because, you know, they'll certainly pick up on that if those things aren't genuine. If they are an act, I think over time you can't fool people. So I think as long as you're a good person with the right agenda, I think you've got off to a good start.
100%. Yeah, very, very wise words indeed. And before we go on to the fan questions from Northamptonshire fans, of course, who want to learn a bit more about obviously 2021 in reflection and of course 2022 and the future beyond that, I do just have one final question, Sads, in particular about coaching. And it's the difficulties associated with coaching because we've alluded to it beforehand already, man management. Now, of course, in cricket, the majority of people, pretty decent folks, let's be completely honest, it's a good game for mostly of good people. But the fact is you do have different characters, you have different styles and approaches to the game. What do you say is the most difficult thing about coaching that you've experienced so far? Would it be man management? Would it be the disappointments, the expectations, the pressures associated with coaching? What do you say is the biggest pressure or difficulty associated with the art of cricket coaching?
Wow, brilliant question. I think what is difficult with the coaching hat on sometimes is that, you know, you have to allow the lads and the players to be able to be free to do it their way. You know, you can't always pigeonhole people to go and bat in a certain way or bowl in a certain way or behave in a certain way. You have to allow them to be their own character. But there's times where, you know, the players, you offer a suggestion or a bit of advice or you try and do something and it's just not going in and the player really kind of disagrees with you or whatever. The difficult bit is then being able to kind of accept that it's the player's decision. It's on them. They have to decide how they're going to go about their business. And sometimes the difficulty is you can see that things really, really aren't going to work or you know, you've got red flags that you think something's not going to work for a certain person. The difficult bit is knowing when to say something and when not to say something, because there's times where you just got to let the lads go and try and be as, you know, do it their way, be the best they can. And knowing in the back of your mind, experience might tell you that actually it's not going to work. Or it's reducing, or it's going to limit them in a certain way, whatever that may be. So that's always an interesting dynamic to get right, is knowing when to say something and when to step in and offer a suggestion or sometimes the best thing as a coach is to just kind of say nothing and allow the player to work it out themselves. But, you know, deep down that player has to know that you're supporting them and you're on their journey. So a difficult bit would be sometimes where you know that a player might be struggling and you want to make that change, but actually you have to kind of let them go a little bit. So it's never easy.
Yes, Sads, to be honest, I'd completely agree. I mean, coaching it's a very intricate art form, isn't it? There's so many different things you have to manage. And of course, another factor, an external factor, of course, in the professional world is, of course, fans' expectations. And I think that that actually brings us nicely onto our fan questions from the Northants faithful. First of all, thank you to each and every single one of you who did send in your questions for today's podcast. And I think we'll start with 2021, to be honest, first, Sads, because, you know, it makes sense, chronological order, all that good stuff. So we'll start with James. James is a long-term follower of the podcast. So James, Terry, thank you very much for sending this in. Sads, he says, what were the reasons, as you personally see it, behind the county's lackluster Royal London One Day Cup performances? What do you think was the overarching factor behind that disappointing campaign for Northants in the 2021 Royal London One Day Cup?
Well, I don't know if there's any kind of one reason that we didn't kind of do very well in it. I think it's probably a culmination. I think if you look at our white ball cricket over previous seasons, you know, we've not covered ourselves in glory. And I think that one of the frustrations is that on our best day, we can beat anybody, and we've got the skill set and the character in the group and the talent in the group to beat anybody. But on our worst day, you know, we were quite a way off. So I think the gap between our best performance and our worst performance is probably a little bit too big. So we have to kind of address that and make sure that our gap's small. If you look at the best performers in anything that they do, the gap between their best performance and their worst performance is quite small. So I think that's certainly an area that we need to kind of work hard on in coming months and years, is to make that gap smaller and get our worst performance not quite as bad. But in terms of one reason why we didn't really do well in that comp, I don't think there is one. There's probably a mixture of a few reasons, but, you know, our worst performance was probably too far off.
Yeah, I mean, as you said, it's about not so much consistency, but reducing the gap, isn't it, between your lowest performance and your best. I do think of one particular performance, to be honest, in terms of one of the worser ones, probably was at Edgbaston, to be honest, against a very, very inexperienced Warwickshire side. But to be honest, season like that happens, so it's just one of those. And this next question actually relates to next season, and it's from another James. Another James is a Northants fan this time. It's James Bashford. Sads, is the club prioritising white ball cricket next season? And how does the club aim to do better in the T20 Blast and, of course, the Royal London One Day Cup in 2022?
Well, good question. I think what we will do this winter is we will invest a little bit more time in some white ball skills and give those lads the opportunities to invest, to get better in certain aspects. I think a bit of role clarity is always good as well. So, you know, we need to work out how we're going to go about our business, what people are going to do which role. And then, you know, sometimes investing time in making your strengths even better is really important. So, I don't think there's one set reason why we've been off the pace. You know, we've been a bit unfortunate with a couple of injuries and what have you. And, you know, our overseas star, Mohammed Nabi, he was in quarantine for the first five games or four games, whatever it was, which is never good. I mean, it's not an excuse, but these are all kind of contributing factors. But I think, you know, we are going to invest some time as a group in our white ball skills. And try and develop that over this winter and beyond, to answer James's question.
Well, there you go, James. I think that is adequately answered, to say the least. And of course, Northants over the years have definitely, you know, punched above their weight, I suppose, in white ball cricket. I think, of course, in the T20 Blast 2013 and 2016, incredibly, incredibly memorable performances. And again, this is going to sound so nerdy, but if we're looking at it from an analytical point of view as well, Northants used to employ something very similar to sabermetrics, which is something used in baseball. It's basis behind Moneyball. If anyone's ever seen that film, it's about the Oakland Athletics. Definitely worth a watch for any stats nerds out there like myself. And it was just so interesting, the recruitment, the likes of Richard Levy, and of course Azzurilla. And that culminated in two successes. It's been extraordinary, to be honest, the past decade in terms of some Northants' performance, and fingers crossed in 2022, Sads, of course. The Steelbacks can replicate some of that success. And talking of 2022, this is a wonderful question from Andy. Who would you say is your player to watch out for in the 2022 season, first of all for Northants, and second of all in the wider county scene? That is a tough question, Andy. A very, very tough question.
It is a tough question, Andy, and thanks for that. I'm not going to name anybody at Northampton, because I'd name everybody. I think we've got to look out for more, because I think we've got some brilliant players, so I'm not going to fall down that trap, Andy. I did like the look of Yates, actually, when he played for Warwickshire. We saw him a couple of times this year, and I did think he looked a very, very good player. But there's loads of good players out there, isn't there? There's some incredible talent on the county scene. there's a good mixture of youth and experience throughout, and there's always, county cricket will always produce these fantastic players. So I'm not answering Andy's question, the first part of it, but you know, there's plenty of players out there that are exciting to watch.
There are indeed. And it was a tough question. I knew that'd be an incredibly tough question. Andy, I'll answer the Northants bit because I'm coming from more of a neutral perspective, of course. But there are a lot to choose from. I'm going to be honest. This is from a fan's perspective. Harry Goldston looks like a very, very good young player, as does James Sales. I really, really like the look of that. And of course, there's the, you know, the family element behind that as well, with David having played for Northants. So I think that's a lovely, lovely story as well. Freddie Heldrake, which is fantastic, with regards to another left-arm wrist spinner in county cricket, alongside the likes of Jake Lintott and Hampshire's Darcy Short. And then, of course, Emilio Gay, another incredibly talented cricketer. We've had him here on the podcast. Such a mature, level-headed, talented player at the age of 21 years of age. The future does look incredibly bright at Northants. So there are definitely positives to look at ahead of 2022. And I've only just mentioned four there. Gus Miller, who's just signed a new contract as well. Safe Zabe, who's a gun fielder. Like, yeah, the pieces are in place, shall we say, for the future up at Wantage Road. And talking of 2022 then, Sads, this takes us nicely onto our next one. This time it's about the county championship. Again, this is from James. James Tarry, I should elaborate on that. Is the county looking at winning the county championship in 2022? Is that a goal for you personally as a coach, Sads? Maybe not necessarily next year, okay, seeing as it is your first year, unless you're doing Mark Robinson. Who knows? It's plausible. Robbo showed it at Warwickshire. But in terms of your stint as head coach at Northamptonshire, is the county championship the holy grail per se in your coaching stint?
Absolutely. You know, we're here to win. And you know, there's a lot of time, effort, energy and sacrifice that goes into doing this. I know people see the good side of coaching and playing and being a cricketer. There's also a lot of sacrifice in there. And I think anybody who does it without the, you know, the drive to win games and win competitions, then I think, you know, they probably should be doing something else. So to answer the question, do we want to win the county championship? Absolutely. We know how tough it's going to be. We know that there's a lot of competition out there. We know that other teams potentially have, you know, a few more resources than what we have. That's fine. But it's about kind of us using what we've got to the best we can, being as efficient as we can, and trying to give the lads the support and the platform to go and express themselves and perform. So absolutely, to answer the question, are we here to win? Yeah, we want to win. That's the drive, that's the dream, and that's what we're here to do.
Good answer. Very, very nice answer, that, Sads. Of course it is. I mean, if you're going into a season not wanting to win a trophy, there's no point in you turning up, to be completely honest. The fact is, sport is very, very funny. Cricket is a funny game. Anything can happen. I mean, I alluded to it there, Warwickshire. As much as I give it large on the podcast about my beloved Bear Ragged staff, I didn't expect that this season. So if you're a Northants fan, if you're a fan of any county, just go into that season believing anything can happen. It's a funny, funny sport. So 2022, we shall have to wait and see what treasures lie in store for the counties ahead of next season. In terms of our final fan questions then, John, I mean, some easier ones. I'm going to be honest, I've got the tough ones out of the way, so we'll have a nice relaxing unwind end to the podcast. So this one is from Andy again, and he says, who in the squad is least likely to buy a round of drinks at the bar? Who's a bit tight?
There are one or two candidates, but I think it would be wrong of me to divulge that information right here, right now. But those candidates know who they are. And no doubt if they do listen to this, they'll be having a little giggle. So unfortunately, Andy, I'm not going to answer that question.
Moving on to our last few questions. This is from Martin Standish. Martin pretty much taking on the Aaron role here, asking some teammates questions. So thank you for this, Martin. These are some good ones as well. So John, this first one, what's your go-to karaoke song? If you had to, you know, get up in a bar, sing a certain song, what do you sing and why?
Well, my go-to is the Proclaimers' 500 Miles. We have to do an initiation, obviously, when you join a new club, and I had to do it last year with Northampton. And the reason for that is that I'm a big believer in crowd involvement. So, you know, most people know that song and it can get going. It can get quite loud and a bit rowdy, which is part of the fun as well. So I'm not the best singer, so I'm absolutely never going to go for a choice where my voice is heard. It's more of a song choice where I can shout as loud as I can, bang my hand on a table and hopefully the lads will sing along with me to drown out my voice. So that's pretty much my go-to song, the Proclaimers 500 Miles.
It's a good choice. As you said, everyone knows it. I mean, the classic ones when it comes to karaoke, that is one, of course. In county cricket, what else but Sweet Caroline? An absolute tune. I think that's known all around the globe. And of course, some Oasis, some Wonderwall. That always gets the crowd going at the karaoke, to say the least. Moving on to the next one from Martin. Well, this is an interesting one, actually. Will you be allowing football in the team warm-up? Now, this is a controversial topic in county cricket and cricket in general, of course. We've seen with England, they have banned football from the warm-up as a result of, let's face it, quite a few injuries over the years. The biggest one in recent times being Rory Burns. Will you be allowing the lads to play football? Or I know there's another one. I forgot the name of it. It's not a horse. What's it called?
Pig.
That's what it is. Will Pig be involved in the warm-ups?
Well, Pig has been involved all year, and it's been a brilliant game. It it highlights who's got a decent touch. Mm-hmm. There is a question out there that, you know, there is a belief out there that whoever's the skill levels of Pig don't directly correlate to who's a good footballer, of which anybody who fails at Pig will tell you. Pig's been a great game. You know, we had an injury. Gareth Berg actually got injured this year playing Pig, and it was the most innocuous thing, bless him. He literally turned in slow motion and fell down in a heap, hurt his ankle. So there is that element as well. But Pig's a great game. To answer your first question, we're going to allow football. Yes.
Oh, okay. That's interesting. I mean, to be fair, when it comes to the players, I think there is a consensus. People like it, don't they? It's a great way of getting the competitive juices flowing, I think, with regards to cricket. But you do run the risk, don't you, of an injury or two.
We do run the risk, and it's a debate we've had as a management team already, actually, in this last kind of couple of weeks since the season finished to now. And we've decided that we will. Yeah. Now, ask me in a year's time if two of my players get injured the day of a quarter final, and they get injured playing football, I might look on it very differently. But I also know the benefits that football brings. So I don't think it'll be every single day. But there'll be certain times in the year where a game of football is good. It's hidden fitness. It's a bit of competition. It brings so many good things as well. So as long as it's done in a controlled environment, and the lads, if they choose not to play, then fair enough. But I do think a game of footy can always be a good pick-me-up. So to answer your question, yes, but it won't be every single day, I don't think.
I think that's sensible. And of course, when you're playing football, you don't want people going around, 2-foot tackling. This, that, the other, you do have to control it a little bit, don't you?
Well, yeah, I mean, that'll be the thing, that if that starts to happen, then we'll call a halt to it straight away. We have to be smart. But, we've got a smart group, so no doubt they'll be very controlled.
Well, there you go, Northants fans. Fingers crossed there are no injuries, of course, heading into next season. And, of course, this is the last one from Martin. I like this one because this is very much related to coaching. What is your favourite method of team bonding? So what do you think, what kind of, activities, maybe off-field things, do you think can get the team together? What do you think brings a team together in terms of, specific activities and things to do, Sads?
Well, anything that involves a little bit of fun, a little bit of camaraderie, anything that allows the lads to kind of express themselves, anything that potentially sometimes makes them a little bit vulnerable as well, whether it's singing a song or telling a joke or whatever it may be, I think, there's a lot of trust can be gained in relationships when people share their vulnerabilities, so anything like that, but anything that puts a smile on the face. Some people like to go for a drink and have a catch up. Other people like a coffee. Other people want to go paintballing. So I don't think there's one size fits all. It's more about a blend of all those things that allow the lads to kind of, express themselves and also kind of generate those relationships away from cricket. Sometimes it's nice to get away. So I know what you wanted me to say. I know what Martin wants me to say. It normally involves a pint and catching up, doesn't it? And there's a lot to be said for that, but I think anything that allows the lads to express themselves, share some stories, have some fun, put a smile on faces, I think anything that does that is a good way of bonding.
100%. It is sad. And I'd love to know your thoughts on one particular exercise. As soon as I saw this question, something immediately popped up in my head. For anyone who's seen The Edge, which is a fantastic documentary, it's about Andy Flower and his time as England coach. And this was before the Ashes, the 2010-11 Ashes, which of course England went and won. And there is one particular scene one particular segment, and it makes me laugh, but it also makes me think, oh goodness me, I'd never want to do that. And it's the boot camp in Germany, where it's raining, they're with ex-special forces. I think they were Aussie special forces as well, which obviously is quite funny because they wanted the players to, you know, get the rivalry going. But they had to like lift logs, do press-ups, you know, wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning, sleep deprived, go on jogs and marches. And there's the whole thing with Monty Panesar and his logs as well. Do you think that's a useful way of team bonding? I mean, it worked for England. It worked for Andy Flower. I'm not sure the players particularly liked it. In particular, KP, I think he was massively against it, as was Monty. But do you think that is a way in terms of, you know, getting these players to have that shared experience, as you mentioned, be open to their vulnerabilities, per se?
Well, I think anything that puts the lads out of the comfort zone, as long as there's a reason why we're doing it and the reason why we're doing something is explained, then I think anything like that can have value. It may not have value with everybody. You're never gonna do one thing that everybody connects with. So sometimes it's a blend of doing different exercises. But I do think there's a bit of mileage in, you know, getting the lads out of their comfort zone a little bit and you know, making them, challenging them in ways that they might not have been challenged before. And sometimes when you look back on them, I mean, I've done those myself, you know, and I hated it at the time, you know, but then when you finish it and you go back and you reflect, then some of the stuff you look back and think, you know, well, that was all right. We created a memory there and we created something that we can talk about in 20 years when we see each other. So, you know, I think there's mileage in anything like that. I just think it's got to be planned and it's got to be, there's got to be a reason why we're doing something. I think if there's a reason why we're doing something and people can connect with it, then I think it'll be all right. If people are doing stuff just for the sake of doing it, then I think you're going to lose people.
100%. And it's funny you mentioned about planned. I mean, Andy Flower clearly planned it. I don't think he told the England lads, though, which was quite funny. In particular, Graham Swann. As I said, if you want to watch this, watch The Edge. I cannot recommend it enough. I think it's free as well. You can get it on iPlayer. It is a really, really fantastic watch to learn, you know, more about that incredible England team, which rose to the top of the world rankings in the Test arena. But it's a hilarious and at the same time, absolutely daunting segment, to say the least. But it is very, very funny. I'm going to be honest. I'm not sure I would, you know, I would do it because I'm up for doing stuff like that. Like, I don't mind camping and obviously out in the countryside, you're used to, you know, stuff like that. But I just think the physical exertion of that, when you're already tired, getting up at 4 o'clock every single morning, someone shouting at you, you know, knocking little tins and cans and, oh, you know, I don't think I'd fancy that person. It sounds like absolute, sounds worse than I'm a celebrity, to be completely honest.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the thought of me doing that as well sounds a bit daunting as well. I'm not sure I like that idea of myself doing it, but you know, look, whatever it is, I'm sure we'll have to, you know, and this is what I want the players to lead. We've got two good captains. I want both of those to have input in what we do. You know, they're leading the side on the field, so they've got to be part of how we kind of plan things as well. So, you know, convincing those two to go hiking at 4 a.m. Might be a challenge. But if they come up with the idea, then let's go with it. So again, all these things have to be discussed and planned.
They do indeed, yeah. And to be honest, Sads, I think that is a wonderful place to finish today's podcast. Apart from one question, I do just have one final wrap-up one, of course, which we always ask here on the County Cricket Podcast. And that is, what's next for John Sadler? Obviously, 2022, I mentioned there about the coaching, head coach position at Northamptonshire County Cricket Club. But what steps are you going to put in place ahead of 2022? What are you going to be doing over the winter and the off-season in preparation for March and, of course, the pre-season preparations? What lies next for you, Sads?
Well, this last couple of weeks and certainly the next 3 or 4 weeks that we're away from the ground is a brilliant opportunity to reflect. We've put a system in place where the lads can offer their feedback as well. So I think it's important that they give their feedback for things that they think that we do well and things that they think, you know, potentially we can improve. And I think it's about getting the infrastructure right. You know, we've got a couple of different guys coming in the support staff. We've got a new physio. We're advertising for a batting coach as we speak. And there's a couple of different areas that we may look to kind of sharpen up or improve. So the priority for us at Northants at the minute is getting that infrastructure right and getting the support network behind the scenes right, so that the players have got everything they need to go and play and execute their skills, as we've said. So that's the immediate thing, is planning and prep and getting the right people involved in the right role to give the lads what we need. From there, like we've said, we'll have a give the lads opportunity if they want to improve their skill over the first few weeks pre-Christmas. Lads, obviously, this time of year, as it is all around the country, the lads have a bit of time to invest in their fitness and getting their bodies in good positions, good shape. And, you know, the other side of Christmas is when we have a bit more of a focus on cricket skills and stuff like that. So, you know, it's a bit of a kind of, at the minute, we're just planning how that next 3-4 months is going to look. Recruitment as well with overseas players, that's something we're kind of looking at with Nigel Felton, the DOC. And, yeah, like I said, the immediate bit would be getting the structure and getting the people right. And from there, we can start planning how we're going to win some games of cricket and how we're going to develop the lads to allow them to be as good as they can be. So it's exciting times ahead.
It is indeed, Sads. And I think it goes without saying, but of course, wishing both yourself in that role as head coach and of course, Northamptonshire as a club, the very, very best of luck heading into 2022. It's going to be a fantastic season, an exciting season. We still don't know the exact structure just yet. We're still waiting on, obviously, the announcement from the ECB and the counties surrounding whether or not the championship format will change or remain the same. But either way, 2022, if it's anything like 2021, is going to be a season to remember. So, Sads, wishing you all the very, very best of luck, mate, and absolutely no doubt you'll smash it in the head coach role. Before we leave, though, Sads, just before we wrap up the episode, anything to plug or promote? Social media channels, for example?
As an employee of Northants County Cricket Club, I will always plug their social media sites and their website and everything that is Northants. Other than that, no.
Fair enough. Well, of course, Northants fans, you know what to do. Follow them on Twitter, Instagram, follow the live streams as well. Do all of that good stuff. Just support the boys heading into 2022 and, of course, the years beyond. But that is it from us two here at the County Cricket Podcast for today's episode. To all of you wonderful listeners out there, thank you very much for tuning in. And as always, guys, we'll see you on the next one.